Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
Okay. This is Cam Wells here with
Marina Morrow.
She'll be telling us a little bit about her experiences with disabilities and a book related to this. So what can you tell me about your book and overall experience?
Well, the book that has just recently been published by the University of Toronto Press is called Critical Inquiries for Social Justice and Mental Health. And the book itself is a compilation of, I can't even tell you how many authors are involved, but it's a edited book. My co-editor is Lorraine Halinka-Melko. And the book focuses on critically taking up the whole issue of psychiatry and mental health, kind of disrupting the knowledges that have come out of Western biomedical sciences and replacing that with the lived experiences of people who either identify with mental health labels or who have gone through mental health care or psychiatric systems.
So what were some of the stories that stand out the most for you in terms of the challenges faced by these people affected?
Well, I think the stories that always stand out the most for me are people who have found their way, who are in sort of emotional or mental distress and find their way to try to get some kind of support and end up being harmed in the context of that support. So whether that's, it's often done unintentionally by the providers and done in the name of treatment, but often has been very damaging to people.
What sort of recourse do these people have available? I mean, coming in from a mental health standpoint, someone might say you just invented this claim, for example.
Well, so some of the recourses, I guess, here I'm thinking of work that I've done, particularly looking at people who've spent long periods of their lives in psychiatric institutions and how those institutions have violated people's rights. And there's very little recourse often, although there's tribunals, there's ways in which people can access the legal system, but usually only if they have some kind of knowledge or advocacy to get there in the first place. So often these are clear violations of a person's rights, but like with many other disabilities, it's very difficult to access the mechanisms to have those rights redressed.
When it comes to something like that, it can be that a person doesn't necessarily know they have the right to quality care or something better.
Exactly. And oftentimes in the case of mental health, the person is in so much distress, and often the treatment itself can make the person, I'm thinking of, psychiatric drugs, can make the person foggy-headed, unable to think well, et cetera. So there's that compounds the whole situation.
So for a person with like a mild mental health issue, for example, sometimes going into a less than above board facility might exacerbate or make their condition worse, actually.
But yeah, there's always the potential for that. I mean, of course, there are very many good organizations out there and helpers and professionals as well. But some of what our book looks at is the other side of the story, I guess, if you like.
So Has there been any success connected to the book and raising awareness that you want to highlight?
Well, the book has just come out, and so we're really just hoping that people will have a chance to read it and take a look at it and raise awareness. I mean, one of the things we're trying to do with the book is introduce new ways of thinking about mental health and new ways, new sort of methodologies and research for approaching some of these difficult questions.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for awareness and more equality, what might you say?
Well, I guess in some ways I would say to people that are doing the work in the community, you know, just to sort of thank them, I guess, for their ongoing work, often in the face of very difficult circumstances and often in the case of not very good resources to do the work that they do. Now, for people who aren't really aware of the issues, I think it's really important to recognize that there are multiple perspectives on the biomedical system, and it's important to be educated about those.
So what are the next steps going forward?
So the next steps going forward, I think, is around education, as you mentioned, making people aware of the issues. I think because I'm an educator myself, working within the university, bringing up the next generation of people who will be interfacing with the mental health system or working with disabilities, educating them about the multiple perspectives and experiences of people, I think is critical.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Great, thanks so much.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Patricia Gray, who will be sharing her story of life with a disability. So tell me a little bit about your story of living with a disability.
From the very beginning when I had the accident?
Yes.
Okay, this was back in 76. I was 21 at the time, and I was going on the 401 to London to meet a friend, and a big diesel truck run me off for the 401, and I went out onto the ditch. I flew 30 feet up in the air and landed on a tree branch, and they took me to London, and I was unconscious for over a week. And then I came to. I had things, what do you call those, in your head? Oh God, I can't think of the name of them. Well, they had my head all with these, what do you call those tongs, like they're tongs?
Staples.
And I had them in my head, and I had a cast on my leg, and they didn't know if I was going to make it or not. I wasn't a Christian at the time. Okay, I stayed, but I know there was an angel in my seat there next to me. But anyway, I stayed 3 months up in London, and then I was transferred because I was waiting for a neurologist to graduate because they didn't have one here, and I had to wait for him to get out of school. And then I was transferred to Hotel Du for another 3 months. And then they didn't expect me to live, actually, because I was about a half inch, well, more or less paralyzed more than living. I was about a half inch on my spine from not walking ever again. And then I got transferred, and I started doing physio at Hotel Du. And I got to go and walk again, and I had my cast off my leg. And I was doing really good, so they sent me home, and I was going to, I started going to the gym then. That was back in 78. I started going to the gym and working out and keeping myself in shape, and I pretty well got over it. I went through a big depression, of course, but I overcome that. I didn't have the Lord in my life at the time, and when I met my husband, in 1980, he became a Christian, and I followed suit, and I've been a Christian ever since. I went to Parkwood for like 30 years, and of course, my husband and I aren't together now, so I transferred over to St. Andrews, which I'm very happy with.
So how has your faith played a role in your recovery?
How much, pardon?
How has your faith played a role in your healing?
My faith, I you know what? I was raised a Catholic, and my faith wasn't there. I just didn't think anything about it at all. At the time of recovery, I never even thought about it, period. And then when my husband, He was at GM, and he worked with a Christian guy, and he told him a lot about Christianity, and then he'd come home and tell me, and finally I came that route, and I've been happy with it ever since.
So, what were the greatest support systems in your recovery?
What was the what, pardon?
The greatest support when you were recovering.
Greatest support in my recovery? Once in a while, I would fall back onto the Lord, but not that much because I didn't know nothing. I didn't know anything about it, period. I didn't know anything about anything. Like I said, I was raised a Catholic, very religious in that aspect, but I didn't really know the Lord that well to even think about going that route, you know, or whatever. I didn't know anything about it. Until actually, what happened is my husband took me to a Christian concert in Detroit. I didn't really want to go because I thought it was going to be a lot of hymns and that. And I told him, I said, I really don't want to go because it's going to be hymns. I was really, really surprised about the Christian people. There was a lot, over 4,000 people at the Fox. And it really got to me that that's what this was all about. And that's when I decided I'm thinking about doing something about my life. And that's when I decided to be a Christian. And I got baptized first.
So if you could send any message to the community about injuries such as yours and how to stay strong, what would you say?
Well, number one, if I was to say anything to anybody, I would say, get the Lord, have the Lord in your life, because that's what gives you more strength than anything. Even now that I'm on my own, I still have a lot of pain today. I go through a lot of different things. I still go to the gym. But I think if you stay strong with the Lord, he will show you the road to take, and he'll always be in your corner. He'll always be rooting for you, that's for sure.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Windsor Youth Center is the only drop-in community center for homeless and at-risk youth in Windsor, Essex. WIC provides helpful and experienced staff members and offers several important services such as meals, snacks, opportunities to explore creative expression, resume help, and a safe space for youth to come together. The Windsor Youth Center is open Monday to Saturday from 5 to 10 p.m. and is located at 1247 Wyandotte Street East. Get help or lend a hand right here in your community at the Windsor Youth Center.
Welcome back to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. Earlier in our show, we heard from Marina Morrow and Patricia Gray, who shared her story of faith healing.
With
Catherine Underwood.
And
Nicole Laney Snash.
We're here at the DRPI Summit on Indigenous Culture and Disability. So, can you tell me a little bit about your backgrounds as it relates to this event?
Well, my name's Nicole, and I am the project coordinator for the Inclusive Early Service System Project, which is a project that's examining families' experiences of accessing disability support services for young children in various communities in Ontario. And my work is particularly focused on Indigenous families and their experiences, particularly on reserve. So that's why I'm here. I have a particular interest in how Indigeneity and disability intersect, especially in early childhood.
So what are some of the barriers related to getting services if you're both disabled and coming from an Indigenous standpoint?
I think there's multiple barriers, but generally in terms of accessing services in early childhood, the services themselves have an ideology embedded in them, so that ideology is generally a medicalized way of thinking about disability. So I think for all families who have young children with disability, their faced with having to buy into that way of understanding of disability if they're going to get access. And so Indigenous families who don't culturally align with this notion of disability that's embedded in disability services, they may either not feel comfortable in those services or choose not to access those services at all. And on top of that, there's a geography related to access to services. So we know from our study that particularly Indigenous communities in the north do not have access to the same number of services. In urban centers, we have far more services. We also have more Indigenous service organizations where they can, who have enough staff that they can actually think through Indigenous ways of working with and including children with disabilities.
So what would you suggest to someone who's looking to break down some of these barriers trying to get equal access?
I think there's like also a layer of pathologizing of children's abilities that happens in the early years of and within our education system, that indigeneity ends up becoming sort of a marker for particular disabilities such as learning disabilities or different ways of learning, and that is what then becomes labeled and diagnosed as a disability that then requires some sort of intervention. So I think thinking through what maybe Indigenous communities see as valuable for their children to learn is one way of sort of mitigating a little bit of that diagnoses that happens for children, but that also thinking through what different ideologies of ability mean for different communities might help to sort of create a system of services that is less laden with these ideologies of ability. All the institutions that people interact with that are mainstream institutions generally have value attached to them, even though we don't necessarily see that all the time. So sort of thinking through ways in which those value systems can be opened up for other places to make their own values.
Well, one thing I have encountered with some of my previous interviews, specifically around Indigenous peoples and disability, is a lot of cases you'll find like a low-income family coming from Indigenous background, and their child might not have access to the proper nutrition or the proper health care, which can lead to the risk of creating a disability where one didn't necessarily need to be there. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think when we think about the intersection of disability and indigeneity, we also need to think about the intersections of all sorts of other things and how colonization has sort of played a role in, at times, creating disablement for children. Many of the families that we talk to are experiencing poverty, addiction, their own mental health issues, and that definitely influences the ways in which they are able to parent their children or support their children in accessing different services. So I definitely think that disability can result from sort of these other processes of intergenerational issues that have occurred that needs to be sort of thought through.
It might also be that impairment can be caused in that way, but the experience of actually disability happens in a cultural context, and that cultural context is plural for Indigenous peoples in this country. When they access services, it's typically in non-Indigenous spaces, but as described here in this circle today, it also happens within Indigenous communities where people experience exclusion on the basis of disability.
Well, for these people who are being excluded or denied equal rights, equal access, in some cases that could lead to depression, which unto itself is a mental health issue, which is a form of disability. So basically what we're doing is ending up creating these disabilities for these people. But to my own thinking, the biggest disability is prejudice, and that's something we impose on ourselves.
We actually were just talking about, in addition to depression, there's also issues around attachment. So in infant mental health, people are very interested in attachment, children's attachment with a caregiver. But we actually have seen that it's a mother's attachment to their child is also impacted when they're removed from a community in order to get health services. So, for example, a child who's born with addiction or with other impairments that may be caused by environmental factors, that parent loses the opportunity to bond and attach to their child too. And that is also has a tremendous impact on a child's lifelong experience, as it does for the parent.
So it comes down to a matter of self-image in their disability. I recently covered a case in which a blind girl in Ethiopia was essentially excluded from her family, and she hadn't been found and given some support. She might have gone through life with this whole perception of, I'm from a different background, I'm not worth it as a person because I have this one factorial difference. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that happens for Indigenous children too, that there is sort of this dichotomy that happens between a positive cultural identity as an Indigenous person and a positive disability identity, and that there isn't a lot of opportunities for children to learn about this intersection and this middle place of, that I am Indigenous, that I am disabled, and that both of those things add value to my being. And I think cultural perceptions of disability have been that adds value to not only that child but also to the community, because that everybody then learns from that person, and that person's purpose is to teach the rest of us something. I think that is missing from many of our institutions, and I think even from Indigenous institutions, that's not necessarily something that's readily available to help support families who have children with disabilities. There isn't a way to support them to also develop a positive self-identity as someone with a disability in that kind of cultural perspective.
So if each of you could send any one message about the ways in which we can promote equal access and promote the worth and the value of any person, regardless of where they come from or what makes them unique, what would you say?
I think one of the things is that we're very focused on intersectionality as it's embedded within individuals, and of course each of us has a right to identify in multiple ways. No one of us is singular in our identity, but I actually think that where we can break down our own colonial practices is through looking at the intersectionality of our social policies and our legislation and our institutions. So we have a very singular way of thinking about problem solving at a large societal level. We have programs for autism services, programs for speech and language services, programs for occupational therapy, and embedded in that we look at children as being only one characteristic, or their families as being only one characteristic. And we're never going to do what our intention is with social policy and social services, which is to act as a community, until we recognize that the intersection of those policies happens in the lives of individual people. So when we're talking about new legislation for accessibility in Canada or for childcare, we need to recognize that many, many different kinds of people are going to be taking advantage of that kind of legislation, and it needs to be written with that in mind.
I think in terms of thinking of accessibility, that we need to sort of decolonize what we think of as disability and sort of stop seeing that as a disruption of an individual, that people inherently have values and that their abilities are representative of their internal purposes, and how that is interpreted by individuals is a choice. But I think on a grander level, we need to sort of shift our culture of thinking about disablement to actually see that as adding value to our communities and to our social policies and to our education system, that each person comes through it that teaches us something about ourselves, and that we can be continuously adapting and be ready for everyone to be accessing the types of services that we're engaged with.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To end off today's show, we're going to hear from Brian Granby, who will be telling us a little bit about disabilities dentistry. So tell me a little bit about the grand opening of the Disabilities Dental Clinic.
Absolutely. So what Little Bird Pediatric Dentistry is the name of our clinic, and we're opening up in Milton. We're actually just right now in our soft opening, where we're working through the all the technical things that will help us be optimized as we go through. But Little Bird is all about essentially two pillars, one being pioneering a whole new way of bringing community-based care for persons with special needs. So we've got a design that features items from Snoozilin. Snoozilin is another word or the brand for controlled multisensory environment. And so we've created a design that feels more like home and integrates these elements for particularly persons with special needs, that makes them really feel like they're in a comfortable, relaxing place. Does that help answer your question there?
Yes, indeed it does. So what inspired you and Dr. Siegel to get involved in disabilities dentistry as opposed to just the mainstream variety?
Absolutely. Yeah, great question. And so a lot of this stems from my wife, Dr. Siegel. She, her father has been a hospital-based pediatric dentist for about 30 years. And so it was instilled in him from some of his mentors. And ever since Allie, my wife, has been a child, she has been involved in patients with special needs, from being a guide runner in the Special Olympics, volunteering every opportunity she could. She found a way to give back to this special population. So it came from her father, but then also just came from an interest as she started some of those early volunteer years, and then really understanding the lack of care that there was out there in the world of pediatric care, and specifically for patients with special needs in the dental world. She knew she had to do something about it, and that's where Little Bird was born, and also where her charity, or not-for-profit organization, I should say, also came about, which is called Oral Health Total Health, and that's all about advocating for oral health care for persons with special needs as well.
So in your time working in this field alongside her, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Sorry, Cam, I missed that last question. It cut out a bit there. I apologize.
That's all right. So in the time the two of you have spent working in special needs dentistry, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, you know what? For me, it's it may not be one particular moment. Honestly, I think it's every single day. I think about moments even just in the past week where within our clinic we've been able to treat patients and do more care in a given appointment than we ever have before. Typically in a hospital-based setting where we historically would have been working. Now in a community-based setting, really designed to optimize this care. These patients are absolutely such lovely people, and they give it to you straight in terms of honesty and those reactions. So I just think of every single day where we see those smiles and we see their reactions. So I can't really point to one individualized moment. There's just so many of them as these patients come through the door.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
For those of you who remember the early days of the show, you might recall Dr. Siegel made a couple of appearances to talk about oral health, total health. The fact is, this is something we as a community need, in so much as no matter what a person believes, how they get around, where they were raised, if they have a disability, they are indeed entitled to equal access and equal consideration. And we as a society need to look at all aspects of care and what's available. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.